You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. The Confederated Tribes of the Grande Ronde is looking to acquire around 26,000 acres of U.S. Forest Service land in the Siuslaw National Forest in Tillamook County. The expansion would more than double the size of the reservation, according to tribal representatives. The expansion plans have been under discussion with Tillamook County leaders for several months. At a recent meeting, the County Board of Commissioners signed a letter of support for the proposal. Tribal leaders pointed to a successful track record of managing lands with conservation and restoration goals. County commissioners said there could be some complications tied to 4,000 acres of federally managed timberland in the proposed parcel from which Tillamook County receives revenue. Commissioners said even the small amount of revenue the county receives from this land is important given the tight budget. However, the commissioners unanimously approved the letter of support for the tribe's proposal. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. Oregonians in their peak earning years are moving out of the state faster than their 30 to 50-year-old peers are moving in. That's according to an analysis of the most recently available U.S. Census data by the Oregon Journalism Project. The largest influx of new Oregon residents are young adults, either college age or relatively early in their careers. They're earning far less than those leaving. Eco Northwest researcher Aditya Gadkari says Oregon relies heavily on income taxes and suffers more from this outflow. He says job opportunities, affordable housing, and education choices all play a role in who moves in and out of Oregon, but that getting more people to move to Oregon is key for the state to thrive. To Mark McMullen, a former state economist, now with the Common Sense Institute Oregon, affordability is a significant factor. Affordable housing remains a persistent problem in Oregon, with the cost of housing far outstripping gains in household income over the past two decades. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Oregon Journalism Project and was reported by Kushboo Rathore. You can read more at OregonJournalismProject.org. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson officially signed a so-called millionaire's tax into law on Monday. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
The historic law would levy a 9.9% tax on all incomes over $1 million. Governor Ferguson says it would address the regressive nature of the state's tax system.
Washington families whose income is in the bottom 20% pay a whopping 13.8% of their total income in state and local taxes, while the wealthiest pay a far smaller percentage of their income. That's not fair, and that's not right.
Before this law, Washington was one of only a handful of states without an income tax. Revenue from the new measure would go towards the state's general fund, early education and childcare, tax credits for low-income families, and sales tax breaks. It would take effect in 2029. Republicans have already promised lawsuits and ballot measures to challenge the constitutionality of the tax. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
A Republican politician from Southwest Washington went on social media Monday morning to tell people to make their voices heard about the war in Iran. Former Washington State congressional candidate Joe Kent said his followers on X should tell members of Congress to oppose deploying ground troops in the country.
This would be a catastrophic escalation that will only result in more bloodshed and further escalate this disastrous war.
Until recently, Kent was the White House director of the National Counterterrorism Center. He resigned in mid-March over his opposition to the U.S. war in the Middle East. In his own social media posts on Monday, President Donald Trump threatened to destroy Iranian electric plants, oil wells, and desalinization plants. Some veterans may face a harder time receiving federal food assistance. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act that Congress passed last year toughens work requirements for veterans who apply for SNAP benefits. From Fairbanks, Alaska, Shelby Herbert reports for the American Homefront Project.
Ashley Edgington is the volunteer coordinator for Meals on Wheels in Fairbanks. But on a particularly cold morning, and we're talking negative 30s, she's making the deliveries herself.
You're going to also be driving in immense ice fog today. just take it slow and steady.
Alaska has some of the highest food prices in America. It's also home to the highest share of veterans. And for many of them, those two facts collide at the checkout line. There are several food insecure veterans on Edgington's delivery list today. But she says, as a group, they can be really hard to reach.
That population specifically, you have to be one of them. You know, I go stock materials at the VFW hall or the VA clinics.
Part of Edgington's job is connecting her food insecure clients with assistance programs they can apply for, like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. But she says that's out of reach for many. Alaska is experiencing an administrative backlog for SNAP applications.
We've had people who perfectly qualify because maybe their income was zero, but you have months and months and months and months of delay.
And there's another barrier on the horizon. Veterans used to be exempt from the program's work requirements, but the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed by Congress last year, removes that exemption. Most SNAP recipients, including veterans, will have to work, volunteer, or study at least 80 hours a month, unless they're pregnant, responsible for a dependent child, or have a documented disability. Gina Platanino is the director for SNAP at the Food Research and Action Center, a nonprofit advocacy organization that addresses food insecurity. She says it's already hard for many veterans in need to comply with the new law.
This bill didn't come with a job offer, didn't come with, we'll provide transportation, we'll fly you out, we'll provide broadband, we'll provide a computer, we'll provide the training necessary.
Nationally, about 8% of veterans participate in SNAP, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. While 1 in 5 veterans experience food insecurity, many do not claim those benefits. And Platanino says the able-bodied designation might not account for veterans with disabilities that are harder to see.
There's some of them, depending when they serve, that they do come with certain physical or mental disabilities, and those necessarily are not as easily documented or as easily able for them to be exempted.
Under the new law, people who don't qualify for an exemption can receive SNAP for only 3 months out of a 3-year period. In some states, those 3 months are already expiring for veterans. Congressman Glenn Thompson, a Pennsylvania Republican, chairs the House Committee on Agriculture. At a December meeting, he defended the part of the law that removes work requirement waivers for many veterans.
If you're coming out of the military and you don't have a disability, and I mean, I just find that someone that's going from active duty status to veterans, they want to work.
Back in Fairbanks, Edgington comes to a stop at one of the last homes on her route. It belongs to an elderly veteran and his wife who signed up for Meals on Wheels because the food bank is too far away from them to safely drive on the frozen roads.
They have to drive a 35-mile drive, and the husband's on oxygen, so there's a lot of barriers and layers there.
She says she doesn't know what the future holds with the new law, but she urges veterans facing food insecurity to not give up hope and to reach out to local and regional nonprofits for help. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. After the FBI seized hundreds of boxes of 2020 election records from Fulton County, Georgia in January, county officials sued to get back their ballots. Expert testimony in the case suggests the justification cited by a Trump administration official to obtain the warrant had no basis in reality. That official, former 2020 Trump campaign lawyer Kurt Olson, now holds the title of White House Director of Election Security and Integrity. The January 6th Select Committee report cites Olson as drafting the memo entitled "The Role of the Vice President in Receiving Votes from the Electoral College." Olson provided the FBI with the affidavit's justification for the warrant, which included testimony refuted by state and county election officials. March 27th, Ryan Macias, former acting director of testing and certification for the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, testified that there's no basis in reality for most of the witness statements, unquote, and that the information that was relied on doesn't reflect what actually happened. Fulton County Clerk Shay Alexander testified that FBI agents conducting the raid refused to sign the required chain of custody papers for the ballots. Federal District Judge J.P. Boulay voiced concern over warrant and statute of limitation issues. A decision is expected shortly. We've linked the affidavit and more reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.